Thank you.
My name is Lewis, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God, folks like you, I haven't had a drink of alcohol, any of those wonderful pills, or non-habit-forming cigarettes since September the 5th, 1955. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm lying already. 75. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. My God. Ooh. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Dwayne for being such a gracious host, and I do quite a few of these, so, and I can say this is the best food that I've eaten on one of these things. And it is, and they feed you so regular. You know, I had to decline one. So Dwayne has been a great host, and everyone I've met has been real nice. I've got a very easy job tonight because Diane, Linda, Claire, Larry, Pat, Matt, John, and Cindy, they've already told all our stories. At least they've told mine. So all I've got to do is just put a few of the different things to it. I had my first drink at the senior prom in Wagner, Oklahoma, 1957. My girlfriend started dancing with a little boy. Didn't have but two, but I felt normal for the first time in my life. I had my first drunk 2 weeks later at the senior picnic when she started square dancing with the little boy. And I went and found the boy that had the homemade beer. That's what we got off with in Wagner at that time. And I had more than two. As a matter of fact, I got drunk, started a fight between two other people, and threw up on my girlfriend's brand new dress. You know? And that's, you know, and that's my whole drunkalogue, because from now on, whenever I drink, that's what I did. You know, my wife usually comes with me on these things, but 2 weeks ago she went to an Al-Anon conference in Little Rock, and she made a vow she'd never go with me to an AA conference again, because when she went to the conference, she said a lady talked and told a story that she had been married to this abusing alcoholic that abused her physically and mentally for 41 years. Well, he finally died, and he requested that his body be cremated. So she had him cremated. She mixed him with a pound of marijuana, and she smoked his ass, you know. At coffee. And, you know, after they were going around speaking to the speaker, and Earlene said she overheard a lady say, "Well, honey, doesn't it kind of embarrass you to tell people that you smoked your husband's ashes?" And she said, "Oh, no, darling, I lived with that abusing SOB for 41 years. And when I mixed his ashes with that marijuana and smoked him, that's the first time he ever made me feel good." You know, I had my last drink August of 1975. My wife Earlene had been kind of hinting that I might could have a problem with alcohol. So I decided to show this wonderful child of God that I could quit drinking. She took the kids home just before school started. So I decided to quit. On the third day, I went to full-blown DTs, and I fell in the shower and broke both of my shoulders, and I hit my head and had a full-blown concussion. My blood pressure went up to greater than 300 over 150, and my blood sugar went up to greater than 1,000. I somehow staggered out in the middle of the den, and I was just about to drown on my own vomitus when a couple of my old junkie friends came by for me to write them a hot prescription for Dilaudid so they could go sell it and get some heroin. And they saw me lying there just about to drown, and they kicked the door in, and they took me to St. Paul Hospital, and they kicked me out right there on the emergency slab, and they kept on going. And, you know, but they saved my life. You know, two doctors said I would be dead before morning. But, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I had to prove those suckers wrong, you know. They called my wife, and my wife came home, and she decided to kill herself because she knew my mother and my sisters was going to blame this on her. You see, at one time she called my mother, and she said, "Mrs. Dear, I think Lewis might could be drinking a little too much." And my mother said, "Well, he didn't drink like that when he was with me." You know, and she never said another word to my mother, you know. Well, anyhow, Mom, she called suicide prevention. I'll always hate suicide prevention because they convinced her that I was an alcoholic and that she didn't cause it and she couldn't cure it and there was absolutely nothing she can do about it. Well, I promised her, you know, and she decided, and they told her that if you want to be happy, you should get your children and get away from him because he's no good and he'll never recover. Well, I'm an alcoholic. Even though I was lying there in a coma, I talked her into staying and giving me one more chance, you know. You know, even in a coma, I'm that good, you know. And I had this vow that I'd never drink again. But then I had my last drink. And my last drink consisted of, see, about this time I had a routine down. I'd go across the bridge to the liquor store and I'd get 12 half a pints of vodka. I'd stop back by the drugstore and I'd get 25 Seconals. And I'd come home and I'd drink a half a pint of that half a pint of vodka. And I'd take 70 milligrams of Valium. I'm a doctor, and they'd send us all the Valium that we needed at that time through the mail. And I'd take 70 milligrams of Valium. Then I would remember that I hadn't eaten. I'd go up to Church's Fried Chicken and get two wings, two peppers, and two rolls. And I'd come home, I'd eat the chicken, the pepper, the roll, and then I would drink the other half a pint of vodka. And I'd wash down 200 milligrams of Seconal with it. You know, and I'd sleep for 4 hours. And I'd wake up, and I'd do the same thing over and over for 9 days. At the end of 9 days, I'd start throwing up blood from my mouth and rectum. And I would go up to my office and I'd get a bottle of Demerol. And I'd come back home and give myself Demerol shots every 4 hours. And I'd just pass out. And after about 2 days, the bleeding would stop. And then I'd start back to drinking. And so I could just finish my little spree, you know. And I've been in every hospital in Dallas. I've never been admitted for alcoholism. I had one fool admit me for a brain tumor, you know. But the doctors loved me because when I was sober, I was a pretty decent human being, you know. And I woke up that Sunday morning and I was lying next to Earlene, and I was never so glad to be lying next to her in my entire life. And Earlene was up doing what she always does on a Sunday morning. She's getting the kids ready to go to school. She's cooking breakfast. She's hollering and screaming at the kids. But she was doing something a little different this morning. She was packing. And I said, "What's happening?" And she just kept packing. I said, "What's going on?" And she just kept packing. You see, I couldn't get her attention, and I'm an alcoholic, and I must have her attention to divert it away from my drinking and get it on some innocuous thing so I can blame this on her. And I said, and being an alcoholic, I'm very dramatic, and I have several acts to get attention with. So I went into my crying act, and she just kept packing. I went into my mad act, and she kept packing. I went into my bad act, and she kept packing. Things were getting serious. I had to pull my ace out of the hole, so I went into my sexy act, you know? And she packed faster, you know? About that time, the phone rang, and it was my brother from Chicago, and he said, "My nickname is Tuffy, because I'm such a cream puff." He said, "Tuffy, if you're not up here on the next plane, I'll be down there for you." You know, ladies and gentlemen, when your time come, your time come. I guess I could go kicking and screaming, or you can just go. And I said, well, Sonny, I don't have any money. And Sonny said, all right. And Sonny's just kind of lame. He sent cash the first time, you know. And it kind of delayed my trip a little, you know. The second time, he sent a ticket to Will Call, you know. Ladies and gentlemen, I had no concept or any idea I was going to get sober. I was going to Chicago, con my brother for a few days, drink him up, come back to Dallas, you know, and go on back about my business. As a matter of fact, I was an hour late for the plane. The plane was an hour and a half late. I had 18 drinks on the way from Dallas to Chicago. It was the best 18 drinks I ever had because I got so loaded my brother wouldn't take me home. See, if my brother would have taken me home with him, I was going to con him a little. And I was going to tell him something like, Sonny, I'm your brother. And see, the thing about us con men, we must get you to bow in your head. And I'd say, ain't that right? And he'd be bowing a little. I said, you know, I'm living down in Dallas now, and I have him bowing again. And I said, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm your own brother. I'm your flesh and blood. And he would kind of bow a little. And then I said, my problem is I'm living down in Dallas, and you know people in Texas hate people from Oklahoma. Remember OU weekend, Texas OU weekend. And I'd have him bowing by then. And I would cry a tear or two. And I would say, you know what I really need is my brother. I just need some brotherly love. And I had him then, because he'd have a little tear in his eye. But I got so drunk that I, you know, and they didn't have these fancy things when you walk into the airport. You had to walk down in 75 on the ground and then go into the airport. And I somehow missed that last rung on the step, you know, and I started trolling down the runway. And my brother ran and got a wheelchair. He's such a wimp. And he put me in the wheelchair and he called the hospital. The hospital said, well, just bring him on in. Half of them that get here are like that. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I was so angry. I was mad at my wife for calling my mother. I was mad at my mother for calling my brother. And I was mad at my brother for putting me in this hell godforsaken place. You know, it was only the most expensive hospital in the world at that time, you know. But anyhow, I stayed in my room for 10 days. On the 10th day, little old counselor came in and said, we want you to go to group today. And I said, I can't. I'm in detox. And she said, well, if you don't go to group, we're going to bring the group in your room. And for some reason, I got enough courage to go. I hadn't bathed. I hadn't shaved in 10 days. When I walked in the group, everybody just kind of parted a little, you know. You know. And, you know, as life would have it, God had the right man talking, because the only person that could tell me anything was a doctor. And he had the doctor there today, and the doctor was talking about the disease concept of alcoholism. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, he was making the right talk, because I thought I was just dirty and no good. I had no idea what alcohol. I had a great education. I had a private school education. But you see, the days that they talked about alcoholism, I didn't go, because I already knew about alcoholism. We had an alcoholic in our town. His name was Link. He was dirty, nasty, and he was a wino. He was on welfare, and that's who I knew that alcoholics were, somebody dirty, nasty, a wino, and on welfare. Now, you know, of course, and I wasn't like that, so I wasn't an alcoholic, you know. So I didn't go to class those days. I just stayed away. And he described an alcoholism, and he described me to a T. He even described it where my unconscious mind could understand. And I can remember his last statement. He said, we're not, you know, bad, needing to get good. We're sick, needing to get well. And then he introduced himself as a doctor and a member of AA. And my treatment just took off. I got out in 26 days. And I was kind of arrogant. I knew I'd never, ever drink again. Got on the airplane. I saw the businessman having to rush and get them a drink. And I was just grinning and thinking, those poor suckers. And I came home with a firm commitment to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And a firm commitment to get in this program. I got off the airplane. My wife told me that all my furniture had been repossessed. That the two doctors I was working with had kicked me out of the building. And then she dropped it on me. She said the Internal Revenue came by and said I owed them $88,000. You know, I went to my room and I stayed in my bed for 9 days. You know, my wife had to bring food into the room. I had a little restroom associated with my bedroom. On the 9th day, all was lost, and I decided to kill myself. And a little voice on the inside said, why don't you go to AA before you do that? And I said, cool. And I said, I just put my gun in my car, you know, and I'll kill myself after the meeting. You know? So I get in my car and I head toward the meeting. And you know, as I'm, you know, God was in this because everything they had taught me in treatment, I forgot. But I didn't forget the telephone number of the Oak Cliff group, the one that was closest to me. You know, and I headed toward the Oak Cliff group. About halfway there, I thought, I said, now, people in this part of town, they don't particularly like folks of my complexion and melanin concentration, you know. And I said, they'll probably hang me up from the nearest oak tree, you know. And I said, I can't go there. And then the little voice said, well, what the hell are you talking about? It doesn't make any difference. You're going to kill yourself anyhow. You know? So I went to the meeting. I just knew that they would reject me and hate me. But it was an old building, and you see, in 75, AA wasn't pretty as it is today. We didn't have any women in 75 in this group. It was a old bunch of old, dirty, hairy leg men, you know. And when I walked in, though, they all stood up, and they all shook my hand, and they looked me directly in the eye, and they all said, welcome, Lewis, glad to have you, you know. Welcome, Lewis, glad to have you. I don't know if y'all ever been felt like you were less than or more than, never equal to. But that's the first time when they said it that I felt like I had been around some folks that I was genuinely, you know, for the first time in my life, I felt accepted. Now, let me take that back for the second time. The first time, you know, I can remember is I have seven brothers and sisters, and we're kind of poor, and we're from Oklahoma. And I, you see, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a perfectionistic alcoholic. Whatever I do, I have to do it the best. Well, I developed this habit of peeing in the bed. Now, most folks stop peeing in the bed when they're 5 years old. I'm good. I stopped at 14, you know, and I would pee in the bed. Now, all my sisters and brothers, they'd all sleep together. No one ever slept with me. You know, it was just... You know, in Oklahoma it gets cold, not quite as cold as Nebraska, but in Oklahoma it gets cold. And we had a wooden stove, and the wooden stove, the fire would go out at 1 o'clock, and I'd pee on myself about 2. You know, and I would lie there, and it would be cold, and I would start hollering and moaning, and my grandmother would say, get up and clean up. And I'd say, no, Mama, I just want to drown in it, you know, and I just feel so dirty and so nasty. And finally my grandmother would get up and I'd say, Mama, I'm just dirty, I'm just nasty, I'm just no good, nobody else pees in the bed but me. And I can remember my grandmother would put me in the bed with her, and she would hold me and she would rock me, and my heart and my blood pressure would slow down, and she would tell me, son, no, you're not dirty, no good. She said, you're just special. God has something special for you to do, you know. And I feel like a human being for once with my grandmother. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the same feeling. They had those dumb statements on the wall, think, but for the grace of God. You know, I'm a college man. That was insulting to me. You know, they had the steps that I couldn't read. But the only thing I got out of my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a feeling. I got a feeling that I belonged to somebody somewhere. They said, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to 120 meetings in 60 days. I got addicted to AA like I get addicted to anything that changes the way in which I feel, you know. I was just addicted. And for the next 5 years, we worked in our little community. We built AA groups. We developed treatment centers. I mean, I was just Mr. AA. We went to prisons, and I was just Mr. Wonderful all over town. You know, and after 5 years, life was back together. The kids were inviting their little friends over to the house. I even had the Internal Revenue Service on a payback schedule. You know, Earlene, my wife, and I, we could ride in the same car for 30 minutes without pulling guns and knives on each other. You know, life was back together. And I woke up that Monday morning. Life was going good. And a little voice said, Lewis, everything is going fine. Why don't you kill yourself? You know, I don't know if y'all are kind of like I am. When things are going good, I just want to die. When things are going to hell in a handbasket, I'm alive. I'm alert. I'm cutting deals, you know. And that other little voice said, well, Lewis, before you kill yourself, why don't you call your sponsor?
And so I call my sponsor, and my sponsor said, "Lewis, what step are you working on?" And well, I just hung up on that bastard. The idea of asking me what step am I working on. I'm teaching the steps all over Dallas, you know. And I called another sponsor, and I'll be doggone if he didn't say the same thing. I hung up on him. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand, I had 13 sponsors at that time. Now, I don't recommend that. You know, the way I used sponsors was I would call a sponsor and I'd say, "I've got this problem. I'm going to do this. Now, isn't that right?" If they would agree, I would say, "Fine, you're the best sponsor in the world." If they didn't, I wouldn't say anything and I'd just fire them and I'd just get me another sponsor. You know, I had 3 Al-Anon sponsors. They would agree with any damn thing. I call my original sponsor. He was a rabbi in Chicago, and he said, "Lewis, what step are you working on?" You see, ladies and gentlemen, I was doing the steps all over town. I had cross-referenced the steps with medicine and religion, but I just never bothered to take the steps myself. I knew how to teach the steps to everybody else, but I just never took them myself. So he said, "Lewis, either get your book and come up here or go to someone down there that's not impressed with you being a doctor and y'all do the step." He said, "But I want you to do the steps from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You take a big book, he take a big book, and put a dictionary in between you. And y'all let these steps come alive. I want you to identify every word before you go to the next word." I chose a plumber and a builder to do the steps with. Name was Sam. I never like to talk unless I give Sam credit. Sam died on me last year. Matter of fact, both of my sponsors died on me last year. And the first person I sponsored died last year, And Sam and I would meet on Saturday. And Sam would take an hour off of his busy schedule to help me. But it always turned into 2 or 3 hours. So the first thing Sam had me do was he said, "Lewis, what's an alcoholic?" I said, "That's a person that drinks too much." He said, "What's the solution?" I said, "Not to drink." He said, "Lewis, when the last time you had a drink?" I 5 years, 2 months. I knew it down to the millisecond at that time, And he said, "Well, Lewis, are you having any trouble?" I said, "Hell yes, I wouldn't be here." He said, "What's your trouble?" I said, "I'm an alcoholic." He said, "Wait a minute, Lewis." He said, "You said an alcoholic person drinks too much. The solution is not to drink. And you haven't drank in 5 years, but you're still having trouble." And you see, ladies and gentlemen, that was the first time that I realized that I had more wrong with me than just pouring this liquid in my mouth. You see, I still wanted to burn down the Internal Revenue Service building, I still wanted to kill my mother-in-law on alternate months when she wouldn't give me the money that I wanted, I still had all these hates and these resentments within me, but I wasn't drinking and everything was all right. And Sam said, "Well, Lewis, what about the book?" I said, "Well, I know about the book." He said, "Well, Lewis, what about the doctor's opinion?" I said, "Sam, I'm a doctor and I've got my own damn opinion." He said, "What about there is a solution?" I said, "Sam, I haven't had a drink in over 5 years. I know the solution." And he said, "What about the doctor?" He said, "What about something else?" And I said, I had an answer for him real quick. And then he said, "Well, Lewis, turn over to page 64. In the big book." Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a physician and I'm a psychiatrist, and I hate to say this, but I have a subspecialty in substance dependency. But I have studied all the way from the University of Oklahoma to Harvard University, and I have not found anything in life to explain Alcoholics Anonymous better than this big book called Alcoholics Anonymous, all right? So I'm going to talk from this book because this is how I got sober. I didn't get sober at the University of Texas where I work. I didn't get sober there. I got sober with this plumber, us sitting there cursing each other out, and me drawing the Harvard guide on him and him drawing experience on me. And we sit there and argued and fought like two people that, you didn't know what was going on. So I want to talk about the book Alcoholics Anonymous because that's how I got here. It goes on to say, though our decision was violent, crude, step ground, it goes on down to say our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and condition. Our liquor was but a symptom. You see, I thought my liquor was my problem. Now, I was doing real good with Alcoholics Anonymous until he made me read that. See, then he made me flip over to page 62, second paragraph, selfishness, self-centeredness. Come on, read it with me, y'all. That we think is the root of our trouble, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Selfishness, wanting things to go my way. Self-centeredness, thinking that the whole world should evolve around my wants. You know, now this is the first time I ever looked, you know, for a solution to anything other than in somebody else. And then they go down to the second paragraph and they kind of rub it in. You know, so they say, you know, it says, so our trouble we think are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. You know. Now, they got to dipping in my business a little here. You know. And I'm not that much in love with AA like I used to be. You know. And then when he said, Lewis, turn over to page 64 again. And he said, well, we did exactly the same thing with our lives. You know, they're talking about taking this inventory. You know, and I don't like to be taking inventories because, you know, when I read step four, that inventory step, what did it read? The first time I read it, I read it and it said, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of Earlene and her family. You see, you see now. But when me and Sam read it, we read something just a little different in it, you know, and now they're talking about, first we searched out the flaws in our makeup, you know, and Sam said, now Lewis, take that our out and put my in, you know, and now he said, then he said, we took stock honestly. You know, that was very insulting, as if an alcoholic of my caliber could lie. You know. And then I got to search out the flaws in my makeup. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I've always felt inferior in everything and everywhere and everything I've ever done. But there's one thing that I know I'm good at. And that is placing blame for my faults to somebody else. You know, now I have a PhD, a black belt in that. I can make Earlene responsible for anything that comes up in life. And about half of it, she accepts it, you know. But ladies and gentlemen, when I read this, you know, I didn't know whether I liked this AA stuff anymore. Okay, then I had to be convinced that self manifested in various ways was the cause of my problem. And the three manifestations are resentment, fear, and sex, you know. And so Sam and I, we worked and we worked through this thing. And so I talked to Sam, and Sam, I said, well, Sam, what's an alcoholic? He said, an alcoholic, and he told me about the selfish and the self-centeredness. And I said, what's the solution? He said, Lewis, you got to have the spiritual experience. And I said, well, good, I'm Baptist, been a good Baptist all my life. He said, Lewis, it might be just a little different. We're not talking about going to church. He said, we're talking about changing the way you think, the way you feel, and how you act. You know, well, now, I'm a big-time physician, and I started off in life-shining shoes, and now I'm a heavy-hitting doctor, and he's telling me I've got to change the way I think, the way I feel, and how I act. And he said, well, Lewis, let's just take a look at it. He said, let's look at your action. You know, I'm the kind of guy that'll get involved in 15 different things at the same time, and guess how many I complete? Not any, you know? You know, I went to speak in Canada, and in Canada they give you a car to drive around for an extra day because you come up there and they let me stay 4 days. And they said, Lewis, now, whatever you do, don't speed, because in Canada they said they put you in jail. So, I, of course, driving up and down the mountains, Earlene looked down, and I was going 85 miles an hour, and Earlene screamed and said, where are you going? And I said, well, I don't know, but I'm making damn good time, you know. And, you know, that's basically how my life is, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm getting there fast. You know, feelings. I only had two kinds of feelings, feelings of love and feelings of hate. You know, if I thought you loved me, I had to do something for you. If I thought you hated me, I had to do something to you before you did something to me. And my whole life was spent judging and performing. I've never had a friend until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, ladies and gentlemen. All of my life was a performance, because somehow I knew that if anyone ever really knew me, they would hate me. And so I just performed for everyone, thinking. My high school principal told me this story, and I had no idea it would have any significance to me and in my entire life. We would do urine tests, and the trick is to get you to taste the urine or something. But anyhow, he told a story about deception, and he told the story of this great speaker one night stepping up to the podium, and he reached inside his pocket and excuse me, he set a glass of 100 proof vodka on the lectern, and he reached inside his pocket and he took out an earthworm, and he dropped the earthworm into the glass of vodka. Now the earthworm's body is similar to the internal lining of our bodies. The earthworm swam a semicircle and boom, just evaporated. Speaker stepped back and said, "Now what does that teach you about, you know, strong liquor?" A normal man down on the front row stood up and cleared his throat, straightened his tie, and the speaker recognized him. He said, "Sir, what that teaches us is if you imbibe in strong liquors over a long period of time, it will cause a deterioration of the connective tissue lining of the alimentary canal, therefore predisposing you for ulcers, gastritis, duodenitis, and various other connective tissue illnesses." You know, an alcoholic in the back of the room stood up and said, "That's a lie. That's a damn lie." You know, you know. He said, "What that teaches us is that if you drink plenty of good vodka, you'll never have worms." And you see, I believe it, because I think that as a group of people, we alcoholics and drug addicts, we have been given the greatest mind of anybody in the world. You know, we can drink whiskey for 25 and 30 years, burn up every brain cell that we have. And as Diane said, she went back to the University of Tulsa and made straight A's in law school. You know, we just got, God gives us so much, we can burn up 90% of it and still outdo these normal foods. You know, our problem is this direction. We can take 0.1% of the truth, and we can twist it and turn it, and all of a sudden that 0.1 is 99.1. I don't care how good I get and how religious or how spiritual I get. I just love to lie. I just can't help it. A lie will come out of my mouth faster than the truth. You know, and the first time I tell a lie, I know it's a lie. Second time I tell it, I kind of halfway believe it, you know. And the third time I tell it, I'll fight and defend it to the end, you know. And when I could have told the truth, and it would have been easier in the first place. And I said, "Well, how do you change your thinking, your feelings, and your action?" And Sam said, "Well, Lewis, you got to take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "Well, fine." And he said, "Now, Lewis, you've been to college about 17 years, so we're going to have to break these steps down for an educated fool like you, you know." And so he said, "We're going to break step one down into two parts." And he said, "Lewis, before you can go to another part, you got to explain and break down every word before it, because God wrote these steps and God put these steps here for a meaning." He said, "Words are pretty. They're very poetic. But we got to unlock the meaning of the words." You know, like Joe McQueen in States over in Little Rock, he said, "You got to unlock the meaning of the word." You know, we were powerless. Powerless is a big word. He made me break that word down. I came up with control over alcohol. Now, when I reread it, what I'm really saying is I said that I had lost control over pouring this brown liquid in my mouth. You know, I've got 17 years of college at that time. You know, I weighed 240 pounds, and my voice was real loud at that time. And for me to admit that I can't control pouring this little brown liquid in my mouth, ladies and gentlemen, was almost death for me. And then he said that our nobody knows what life means, but everybody agreed life means at least what we think, the way we feel, and how we act, had become unmanageable. Take that word out, it's a big one, uncontrollable. Now I read the second half of the first step. To me it says, "And that my thinking, feelings, and action, I've lost control over them also." So now I've got to admit that I can't control, as wonderful as I am, I can't control pouring a brown liquid in my mouth. But not only that, I can't even control what I think, the way I feel and how I act. Ladies and gentlemen, that's unpatriotic. That's un-American. You know, I'm an American. We drop bombs on folks' ass when they don't do what we tell them to do. and I got to come here. You know, I went in my high school, they told me, hitch your wagon to a star. You know, this is America. It don't matter if you're black, white, you're female, male, Jewish, Catholic. It doesn't matter. This is America. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. And that's what I did all my life. I stepped on people and almost cut people's head off for 10 points on a test. And ladies and gentlemen, they handed me that degree, and I'm Mr. Wonderful, and I come to you guys, and you tell me, well, you just got to admit that you can't even handle pouring this brown liquid in your mouth, ladies and gentlemen. When I took this step, I was in depression. I was at the bottom, you know. I was ready to die. And then somebody came along and said, well, doctor, when you take step two, you'll have some hope. And let's read step two. You know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Since I made so much fun of step two, my sponsor made me break it down into three parts. You know, number one, you don't start sentences with came, ladies and gentlemen. The syntax is so out of, you know, I'm a physician and surgeon. You don't start sentences with came. Came is what part of speech? Verb. Verbs mean what? Action, you know. I teach at the medical school. I mean, he didn't put that in my vita, you know. My AA vita, I don't put that in. I teach at Southwestern Medical School on Wednesdays mornings. And I go out there and they have me a fresh white coat. And I know it says Dr. Lewis Edward Deer. And that's how I know who I am. It's got Dr. Deer on it, you know. And I put it on and for some reason my voice drops about four or five optics, you know, and I walk down the hall and everybody says, good morning, doctor. I said, good morning. I get very deliberate and I got my white coat on and I'm got proof that I'm a doctor and I run across a bunch of professors. Said, Dr. Deer, how are you? I said, things are going just fine, sir. He said, doctor, I understand you are an alcoholic. I said, that is correct. And they said, I understand you've been sober some odd 20 years. I said, this is true. And he said, well, doctor, we have a bunch of students here, and we just can't seem to get them sober. Doctor, how have you been able to maintain your sobriety for over 20 years? I can't tell that man, well, professor, I'm just came into belief. I can't tell him that, you know. So when they said came to believe, but what I found out is I was making fun of this step one night, and then a little Al-Anon English teacher told me that something is dangling on this sentence, and we put the we came to believe. We add that to it. But came is a verb. The object of it is to believe. And you see, ladies and gentlemen, I have the most negative belief system in the world. Cease from Canada tells a story about my belief system. Cease said there was a little Canadian boy that would go out to play in the Canadian woods every day, and every day he'd get lost. And they'd have to start a search party for him. So C said one day when he came back, his mom said, son, if you go out and play tomorrow and get lost, get on your knees, stick your hand out and pray and ask the Lord to lead you out. The next day, the little boy went out and got lost. He got down on his knees and said, oh, Heavenly Father, I'm lost. And he stuck his hand out and he said, please lead me out. Well, about that time, a bird came along and did number two in his hand. And the little boy just, you know, snuck it off his hand. And I know this little boy was an alcoholic in the making. He got back down on his knees in one of those Joshua poses. He said, oh, Heavenly Father, great architect of the universe, knower of everything from Alpha to Omega. And he stuck his hand out. And he said, hey, man, don't hand me no shit this time. He said, I'm lost, you know, and you see, that's that's my attitude about life. I think that everybody everywhere is trying to hand me a little shit, you know, and I just have to have my portion of shit every day. And you see, and if I don't get my portion of shit from others, I will create my own shit, you know, but I must have my shit. You know, I could wake up in the morning and Earlene can give me a standing ovation for my nocturnal performance the night before, you know, and I'll go into the restroom and I'll reach into my sink and get my soap. You know, and I hate this because that lady over in Bellevue is just like this. And when I get my soap, the soap is mushy, and that makes me mad. I begin to kind of think, what's she trying to do to me? I reach for my toothpaste, and I'll be damn if she's not squeezing it in the middle. And all of y'all know it's supposed to be squeezed from the end. And then I'll sit on my throne, you know, and after I have taken care of my business, I will reach for my toilet paper. And y'all know what's happened. She's got it coming off of the top. And all of y'all know it's supposed to come off of the what? The bottom. You know? And boy, I said, what is she trying to do to me? You know? And when I come out of the toilet, I'm not saying anything. My wife will say, Lewis, what's wrong? Nothing. You know? And that tape will start playing in my head. You know? And that tape will say, you know, your mother told you not to marry her in the first place. You know? You know, and the tape will go back to 1957 when, you know, she was supposed to go to the show with you, and you know she went to the show with Bobby Joe. What's wrong with you marrying this woman in the first place? And it's 1998, ladies and gentlemen, you see. But it's just, I just have to have my own little stuff. You know, belief, ma'am, I have to take some action. You see, I want this program by sitting next to someone that has it. But I got to take some action. This is a step, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm growing with today. You see, I don't have very many problems. I've never had a craving to drink or to use drugs since I left the treatment center. But boy, have I had so many other problems. You see, I've got a wife that's lived with me through deaths and murders, and we've survived any kind of tragedy in the world. My wife and I have survived it. You see, I met her when I was 5 and she was 3, and we started dating when I was a sophomore in high school, ladies and gentlemen. But I've only had one problem. I worked everything down, and I only had one problem in life, and that is I wanted to control what Earlene, my wife, thought, and she wanted to control what I thought. I wanted her to see life the way I saw it, and she wanted me to see it the way she saw it. And you see, ladies and gentlemen, two people can never see life the same way. Because in order to see life the same way, you have to perceive things the same way. And there is no way that two people can perceive things the same way because two people don't see things the same way. So what we see is based on our past experience with a particular object. Now, I'm from a town of 257. I'm a year ahead of my wife in school. But I see things totally different than she does. We had the same teachers, went to the same church. But we see things differently, even physically. In 1992, we had a chance to go to Paris, France. Driving to the DFW airport, and I'm driving. I said, honey, wasn't that a beautiful blue Lexus? She said, Lewis, it was a wonderful car, but it was dark gray. I said, oh, no, honey, it was light blue. She said, oh, no, sweetie, it was dark gray. I said, oh, no, blank to blank to blank, it was light blue. And she said, oh, no, blank to blank to blank, it was dark gray. And, you know, we didn't speak to each other until we got to New York City, you know. And in New York City, we had to speak to each other because no one else would talk to us. You know, we can't even see things the same physically. We were in Paris, France, and we're walking down the Champs-Élysées, you know, that famous street. And I'm just walking and having a wonderful time. The weather's beautiful in Paris. And we approach a tall, statuous French lady. And she's got on one of those Gloria von Furstenberg dresses that wraps around and ties in the front. Well, about the time we approached her, a gust of wind came along and blew the dress open. Now, I need to stop here and teach you just a little neuroanatomy. Now, there is a part in our brain called the basal ganglia. Now, in our basal ganglia, we've got something called a P wave, and the function of the P wave is to scan the external environment looking for some new and unique thrill or stimuli. And for some reason, my P wave must have fallen on the parting of the skirt. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a spiritual man. I'm a Christian man. I probably looked at the lady's skirt parting for less than 2 seconds. Less than 2 seconds. I know it was. But, you know, kind of a warm glow came over me as I walked on down the street. I just casually observed that the lady had on, you know, long black fishnet stockings with the seam up the back, and she had on pink panties with stitched in double old-fashioned lace and trimmed in taffeta, she had on a black garter belt sprinkled with magenta, located 16 centimeters from the symphysis pupus. And it just was just, it just warmed me all over. And I just said, my. You know, isn't God wonderful? You know, I said that, you know, God can take some skin, muscle, bone, fat, nerve, and blood and create a thing of architectural beauty and comfort forever, you know? And I just walked on down the street, didn't say a word to Earlene. I just was warm, and I just knew that was God's gift to me for not, you know, acting out. And as I walked on down the street, we got about a block, and Earlene hunched me in the side. And Earlene said, "Lewis, did you see that bitch?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Lewis, she didn't have a slip on, you see." You know, and I didn't, for some reason, ladies and gentlemen, I could have said five words and the trip would have been ruined. I could ask, "Well, why do you, you know?" And because I can ask a punish, I can ask a question a way to punish you. But I didn't say a word. I just kept my glow, and I went on, and I got up the next morning, and you know, I'm just so selfish and self-centered. I used to think I was shy, you know, but shyness is selfish and self-centeredness. And I always, Earlene kind of sleeps late, and I always wake up at 5 o'clock. I have to start thinking about myself early in the day, you know, and I go down and I drink coffee and I read my book, you know, something that's, it's always something how I'm wonderful to God or something. This morning, as I was walking back up, something said, "Well, why don't you take Earlene a cup of coffee?" And you see, ladies and gentlemen, I don't ever do that. And went on and got her a cup of coffee. And you see, but I guess I need to say I had been praying to God. Please show me how we can quit fighting and arguing. She's my wife. We've been through all of this together. You know, I love her. Please help me with this. But somehow I stopped that morning and got her a cup of coffee. And while I was there, I said, "Well, I ought to get her a sweet roll." And I even took time and warmed it up in the microwave. And I took it back upstairs, and she had just gotten up, and she was sitting in the bed on a pillow, and she was watching Robert Shuler on TV. And I took the coffee over and the sweet roll over to the bed to her, and I gave it to her. And her eyes lighted up, and her skin just lighted up, and she took on a glow, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I bought this woman 4 or 5 mink coats and Mercedes. And now, you know, when we men buy our wives Mercedes, we really buy them for ourselves, you know. And I've got this woman Mercedes, and she just said, "Thank you." But when I gave this woman this cup of coffee and this sweet roll this morning, you know, this lady just was a new person. She had a glow about her. And as I went over and I sat down, a voice on the inside of me, and in a nice, kind tone, tone that I would speak to a patient in, I said to my wife, "Honey, why did you think that lady was a streetwalker because she didn't have a slip on?" And Earlene said, "Oh, Mother told me that. She said when we were getting ready to have our periods, Mother said that if you go out the house without a slip on after becoming a young woman, you're a streetwalker." You see, my wife keeps it simple. You know, I want to mix it up. And anything anybody tell me, I'm believing opposite anyhow. But she just believed everything her mother said, and she just kept it simple. You know, but I've learned the lesson, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I didn't say it in a, I didn't ask the question in a punitive way. I was just nice and kind. For once in my life, I got out of me and got into her to try to understand her and not to control her. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, I use that now whenever I want to get along. Now, I didn't tell you that I do it every day. I think there's something within me that just don't want to get along at times, you know. But when I want to get along, I know how to, because God has showed me. It's to get out of me, get into her, you know, and just be kind and try to understand. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as I understand God. You know, made a decision. To make a decision means to split two facts. What two facts? Fact number one is step one. Step one is we admit it. It's just we kind of said that. You know, I admit to anything if you catch me down to right, you know. But just because I admit to something, I could say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but it's those people I'm running with. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but it's this job I have. So then I got it. That's one fact to admit it. But step two is, am I going to take this action? And that is to turn my will over to somebody else. So I got to make a decision in step three. And if I'm going to stay step one, my book tells me just, you know, read the book again until you're convinced. If not, just go on back out and do some more drinking. But if you want to take the second step, make a decision to take that, it says turn your will, my thinking, and my life, the results of my action, over to the care of God as I understand God on a daily basis. And then 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 is how I turn my life over to God. And steps 10, 11, and 12 is how I keep it turned over to God on a daily basis. How are things today? Erlene and I have two children, 37 and 36. It's just a miracle. They have one job apiece, one car, one wife, one home. On the weekend, they come and steal our van, and they take kids that's never got a chance to go hunting and fishing, and they take them out on the lakes and down on the creek and hunt and fish with them for the weekend. You know, sometimes I wonder if these kids are mine. You know, number one, I've never done anything that unselfish. And number two, I've never been satisfied with one of anything in my entire life, ladies and gentlemen. You know, but they're happy. Erlene and I, April the 2nd, Erlene and I went to Honolulu, Hawaii for our 40th wedding anniversary, you know. You know, unheard of. Ladies and gentlemen, I came to AA. I went on a Sunday night. And I was going to kill myself after the meeting. And I had a spiritual experience at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous like Bill. And I stayed on a pink cloud for the next 18 years. You know, I knew the answer to everything in life. Don't drink, read the book, and go to meetings. I didn't care what your problem was. My dad just that. Don't drink, read the book, and go to meetings. Don't bother about going to his funeral. Just read the book and go to meetings. I had the answers to everything. And somehow something happened to me after 18 years of sobriety, and I began to fall off of that pink cloud. So I decided that I needed to find myself. Had a guy that worked in the office with me, and he had just gone to Egypt, and he came back, and he had this glow about him. And I said, oh, he's found God. And so I forgot it was 132 degrees, and the boy was suntanned, but, you know, but he had this glow. And I decided to go to Egypt, you know, so I could find myself. Now, I don't know why I chose Egypt. I'm from Africa, you know, but, you know, I guess I'm like that guy that lost my key up in the alley, and I go out under the light to look for it, you know. Why I would go to Egypt to look for something I lost in Africa, I'll never, ever know. But I went to Egypt, and it was probably the best thing that ever happened for me, because I went there, and we had a deal. We went up and down the Nile River with an anthropologist for 3 weeks. And I had 59 other negative intellects with me, you know. And you know, we all had black belts in negativism. Somebody would say something negative, another person would trumpet, and the third one would get up and act it out. You know, on the third day, I just couldn't handle it any longer, and I withdrew to the hotel. And I turned on the television. Everything was in Egyptian. I turned it off. Turned on the radio. Everything was in Egyptian. Tried to read the newspaper, and it was in Egyptian and couldn't read it. USA Today was $8, and you had to have a two-week advance. Now, I might have a little money, but I'm not crazy, you know, and I wouldn't pay $8 for a newspaper yet, you know. And the only thing I had to read, ladies and gentlemen, was the book Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 and 12. And that little voice came to me again and said, why don't you read your big book? And I began to read the book, and I got to the steps, and I began to read the steps over and over. I couldn't understand them. And finally, I read step 12 for about the 10th time, and I finally got it. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. You see, ladies and gentlemen, I was kind of scared of AA, and I didn't want to put anything in AA but alcohol. But when I saw to practice these principles in all of our affairs, I would put my resentments and my fears in the first half of the first step, and I worked them through the 12 steps. It took me about 4 years, but ladies and gentlemen, my resentments and my fears are now beginning to leave. Yeah. And I'm beginning to be whole. I had gained about 60 or 75 pounds. I was weighing 246. I had a 51-inch waist, an 18.5-inch neck. And one day I opened the shower door and I had a long mirror and I saw myself and I began to cry. And I began to say, why does everybody hate me? You know. Then I went on and did like that for about 2 weeks. Every day I would say that. And then finally one morning I opened the door and I looked at myself and I said, why do I hate me? And on the third day, I had a dream. And in this dream, I had gone squirrel hunting with my high school principal, my mentor. And we got back to the yard, and a snake came out. And I took a hoe, and I chopped the snake off, and then I chopped the snake up in little pieces. And I took my principal's gun and shot the snake in the head. And the farmer came up. You know, farmers love snakes, certain kinds, because snakes are good for the farm. And the farmer said, Lewis, why did you kill my snake? I said, it was a snake. He said, why did you kill my snake? I said, it was a snake, fool. He said, well, why did you kill my snake? And I said, I hate snakes. And he said, well, why do you hate snakes? He said, has a snake ever bitten you? I said, no, bitten your mom, your father, your daddy, your sister, your brother. He said, Lewis, do you know of anyone that's ever been bitten by a snake? And I said, no. And he went on to teach me that I was taught to fear snakes, and my fear of snakes over time turned into hate. You see, and you know, that's how it has been with people in my life, ladies and gentlemen. My grandmother was a great Christian. She never taught me to dislike or to hate anybody. As a matter of fact, the only time my grandmother ever whipped me is when I told one of my sisters, I'm going to beat you up. And my grandmother grabbed me and spanked me so quick. And she said, all birdies, we dears don't do that. We're good Christian people. And good Christians don't do that. We love each other, you know. And for me to say that. But she taught me to fear everything and everybody. And fear over time turns into a resentment. And a resentment over time turns into hate. And hate over time turns into aggression. And I had gotten, my anger and fear had gotten so much. But the greatest thing I learned, if fear and anger were taught or learned, then it could be unlearned. And that's the great lesson that God gave me out of. You know, and I knew all of this. You know, all of us know all of this unless we've had some trauma to the brain. We know everything that I've said. We already knew it. Because our minds are perfect, and they can't build a computer to hold what our minds hold. But the problem is, it's here, so we have to think about it to act on it. And what it should be is down here in the heart where the action becomes automatic. So my problem is getting things out of my head down to my heart. Now, I'm a scientist, and all my life I've been taught the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. So I was going to make things from my head to my heart. And I thought of this, but if y'all will read some of Bill's last writing, Bill will tell you, the way you get things to your heart, they go from your head to another person's heart, and from their heart back to my heart. From my head to your heart, and from your heart to my heart. So you see, I need you. I need a friend, ladies and gentlemen. You know, a friend, according to the dictionary, is two people that's got something in common. A friend, according to Jesus the Christ, he states that a friend is one that will give up their life for another, like Diana did last night, this big, high-powered lawyer. But she came up here and told you about all of the men and all of the drunkenness. She gave up that high-powered lawyer's life, and she let us see her, that other life that she could help us with. Socrates or Aristotle said that a friend are two people that are so close that they can actually share one soul. Two people and one soul, you know. And I think that's what we are in AA. You see, every time I go to speak and everywhere I go, I'll make two or three friends, ladies and gentlemen. And these two or three friends will have two or three friends. And those two or three friends will have two or three friends. And I've gone all over the country, ladies and gentlemen. And I've established a friendship base everywhere I've gone. For you see, ladies and gentlemen, if I have a friend, then I don't ever have to be alone. And if I don't ever have to be alone, then I don't ever have to fear. And if I don't ever have to fear, then I don't ever have to hate. And if I don't ever have to hate, then I can be exactly what God intended for me to be. And that's just to love each other. And if you don't believe me, you don't need a doctor's degree, master's degree. All you have to do is go by a well baby nursery and check out the babies after they've been fed, bathed, and burped and cleaned. Just go in the nursery and tickle them. They'll gurgle, they'll coo. You stick your finger in there and they'll hug your finger. And you see, they don't care if you're fat or short, wide or slim, black or white, Catholic, Methodist, or Jew. The only thing they want is to love you. But in 2 days now, these people called parents will take this baby home. And they think that they've really got something that's cute and nice, you know? And they take this thing called a baby home. And, well, you heard Diane last night. And all of a sudden, they begin to teach the baby, don't do that. Don't go. What's wrong? What? Are you sure you're my child? You know? You know? And all of a sudden, all of the fears and the anxieties that were held by the parents now has been put into this baby. And you see, ladies and gentlemen, the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous did for me is they took, is the 12 steps took away all of that crap that life, my parents had taught me. And it just allowed the love that God had within me to come forth. You see, when I was born, when we were all born, everything that we needed to make this journey through life was put in us. But society and life put crap on top of it. And the 12 steps of AA just takes all the crap away and makes me livable and lovable again. Life is good. I need you. The greatest gift that God has ever given me was to let me know that I needed other people to make it through this plan, you see. And I guess my greatest gift for you is that somehow God can give for you. When I started my talk, I said that my name was Lewis and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to kind of do it over and tell you that my name is Lewis and an alcoholic is what I am. But through following the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, going to meetings just like this, in little meetings of twos and threes, going to do 12-step calls, going to the prison, getting out of myself, I want to rework it and tell you that an alcoholic, that my name is Lewis Edward Deere. I don't want you to miss me. If you come to Dallas, I'm in the phone book. Lewis Edward Deere. And that an alcoholic and a drug addict is what I am. But through following these little dumb steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that a perfect child of God is who I am. And that's good business. That's good religion. That's good spirituality. And my greatest hope for you is that God can just give you 10% of what God has given Earlene, me and my family. and I can come back to this town, and we can all link arms, and we can travel this road of happy destiny together. Thank you so much for inviting me.